Future-proof extra.
With Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
On News Talk.
Psilocybin is one of several psychedelic drugs, including LSD, ketamine and MDMA, that are currently being investigated as therapies for conditions such as depression and PTSD. Although sometimes the people who are trying to get these drugs into trials are having to face some pretty serious hurdles from regulators. But nonetheless, we do see promising data that have sped treatments towards approval. And scans published recently in the Nature journal offer a rare glimpse into what's actually happening when people take things like mushrooms. Joshua Siegel is assistant professor at the Department of Psychiatry at NYU Langone School of Medicine. He joins me now. Joshua, welcome to the program. Talk to me about psilocybin. What is it and where do we find it?
Well, thank you very much for having me. Psilocybin is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms. And so when I say active ingredient, I mean that's the thing that makes them magic. So that's what causes the psychedelic effects, the visual and also cognitive effects when someone, you know, takes magic mushrooms. And it's a classic psychedelic. And what that means is that it works through a very specific receptor in the brain. It's a serotonin receptor. And that's the same target as LSD and ayahuasca and peyote and a number of other drugs that cause, you know, similar, sometimes slightly different, but overlapping effects, because they're all targeting this same receptor in the brain.
And it's typically found in mushrooms. Are a very specific species of mushrooms or lots of different types?
Well, yeah, it's psilocybin mushrooms. There are a number of types, and you know, they're many native to the Americas. But then there's other interestingly psychedelics that are naturally in other plants around the world. So it's kind of interesting that these psychedelic compounds have evolved in parallel evolutionary paths in different places in the world. You know, this is the compound from magic mushrooms, and actually, you know, the companies that are trying to now get psilocybin approved, in most cases, maybe all the cases of serious clinical trials so far, they're using synthetic psilocybin. So same active compound, but, you know, synthesized in a laboratory rather than, you know, extracted from a mushroom.
Before we talk about, you know, its effect on the brain and so on, I know this may not be your field at all, but maybe you've come across it. Why? I mean, the idea that psilocybin would have evolved, or at least that this hallucinogenic property of psilocybin would have evolved in different species in different parts of the world through different evolutionary paths, seems to imply that it is in some way a useful trait of a plant. What do we have any idea why that might be? Like, why would it be useful to get animals high?
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating question, and I think you're right. It does imply that there's some evolutionary reason, but I don't think there's any consensus on what it is. There's some theories.
Like, you know, like what?
Let's see. I've heard a couple. One is that maybe it you know, when it's ingested, it makes the animal forget where they found the plant, so that they won't come back and eat it. Or, you know, there's some interesting ideas about co-evolution of psychedelics with humans, which actually may have played some beneficial role in, you know, early kind of indigenous cultures. So there's a lot of theories, but honestly, I think they're mostly speculation, you know?
I mean, evolutionary biology in that way can be tricky unless you really have a very close experiment, right? When we talk about animals, the effects we're about to talk about on the brain, they happen not just in humans, but in other animals too?
Well, that's a tough question. I think it's hard to say.
Well, we've probably done experiments on monkeys, right? Monkeys get high. I'm just wondering what other, I know this, we are going to talk about the science. I know this is really flippant, but I was just wondering, like, you know, have we seen horses hallucinate? Just, you know,
there are behavioral effects, but as you can imagine, it's pretty hard to really assess a lot of the signature effects of psychedelics in animals.
Exactly. Okay. So nonsense aside, what is happening in the brain when we take them? Is it a molecule, psilocybin?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a molecule. Yeah.
So what happens to the brain when we consume this?
Well, what happens is, you know, as I mentioned, it's primarily targeting this specific serotonin receptor, the serotonin 2A receptor. There's multiple receptors, you know, for serotonin. And it targets a specific one. And it seems like kind of the natural function of this receptor has to do with a number of things, but, you know, among them is kind of mood and keeping the activity of neurons in your brain organized and synchronized. And that seems to kind of help your ability to perceive and construct reality in an organized way.
Huh.
And so when you take psilocybin, it's a very strong serotonin 2A agonist, meaning it's activating all these receptors. And the consequence is that it desynchronizes all of these, you know, populations of neurons in your brain. So whereas previously they were communicating in a very organized and orderly way, now their communication becomes very chaotic and disorganized.
I mean, that sounds potentially very dangerous. Why does it not have more serious effects on us?
Well, it is potentially dangerous in the wrong circumstances, and it is potentially very powerfully therapeutic in the right circumstances. You know, I think it temporarily can dramatically change how you perceive reality. It can temporarily dramatically change normal patterns of communication between, particularly in parts of the brain that are really key to kind of your sense of self and your sense of space and time.
Hmm.
And by doing that, I mean, sure, it can be dangerous and it can be harmful, you know, particularly when you're, you know, in a, let's say, if you're in a environment where you were vulnerable, you would certainly not want that. But in other circumstances, and particularly in circumstances where someone is, let's say, stuck in a maladaptive pattern of thinking or behavior, that jolt to the system kind of can loosen up some of these strongly built-in habits and enable adaptation.
I want to talk about that in a bit, but when you say it sort of disrupts this electrical pattern in the brain, is it that it sort of turns bits all on at once or shuts down the brain for a bit? Or like, when you say disruption, what exactly do you mean?
Well, yeah. So if it activated everything at once, the consequence would be a seizure. I mean, basically, you know, when there's overactivity in the brain, that's what causes a seizure. And if it shut down everything at once, you know, that is similar to what many anesthetic drugs do, sedating drugs, you know, so it would put you to sleep basically, or put you in a coma-like state. So it doesn't do either of those things actually, you know, it doesn't overall increase or decrease brain activity. It just dramatically changes kind of the organization of brain activity, you know, which under normal circumstances is very structured and very organized. And that kind of, I think, is core to creating our very structured and organized kind of model of the world.
When you're talking about the areas in which this sort of activity is disrupted, is it sort of prefrontal cortex, like thinking, making sense of things, that part of the brain? Or is it across the brain? Is it localized?
Well, so I'll get into a little systems neuroscience here. There is a network of areas in the brain which includes some prefrontal cortex. It also includes other parts of the brain, and it's called the default mode network. And really, I think we've only, you know, started to have a really strong understanding of, well, I wouldn't even necessarily say we have a strong understanding, but started to have an understanding of what this network does in the last 20 years. You know, with some of the advances of modern imaging. And what it does is it seems to create, be critical for creating kind of the sense of self and the sense of you in relation to your environment. And actually, you know, it's the default mode network has been linked to some symptoms in depression and some other psychiatric problems, which is kind of interesting. But it's this collection of areas that, you know, when you take it, it's always functioning. In fact, it's called the default mode network because it's most active when you're not strongly engaged in some activity, right? Like if you're
like cruise control.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're biking to work and focused on, you know, where am I going? How do I not crash into people? What turns do I have to make? It's deactivated mostly, you know. This is what some people call the flow state, right? You're focused. You don't have a sense of self. You're focused on your environment. But then when you stop doing, focusing on an external activity and you're just, let's say, ruminating or reflecting, then it's more active. So that's why it's called the default mode network.
I can understand why this might be a really interesting area to explore, and particularly for, you know, trying to figure out how to treat things like depression and PTSD. Let's talk about your trial, if you don't mind. So you're a psychiatrist and a neuroscientist. And this the work that you did, it's not like a medical trial, it's not a clinical trial. But you gave psilocybin to some volunteers. Can you talk me through what you were doing and what you saw?
Sure. So it was in healthy human volunteers with no psychiatric illness. And there was actually a small number of volunteers with just 7 individuals. But what was kind of unique about it is that we get a very detailed, we basically had these folks come in every other day for a month so that we could get a very detailed picture of what their brain connectome looked like. And then in the middle of that month, we give them psilocybin and did imaging while they were on psilocybin, but then also intermittently for the weeks after. And part of the goal, so there's kind of 2 goals, right? One is to understand what is the drug doing to the brain while it's, you know, while you're having this unique psychedelic experience. And then the second is, are there lasting changes afterwards? And, you know, in particular, like there's been these promising results in clinical trials with psilocybin showing the potential to be antidepressant, the potential to be anti-addiction in some cases when combined with the right kind of psychotherapy. And so it raises the question, well, what is, you know, then there must be something changing in the brain that causes this change in mood or change in behavior. And so that was really the goal of our study, was to try to start to get some insight into that.
It's an interesting experiment. I presume these people weren't tripping balls. Like, I mean, I would imagine it's quite a boring experience of mushrooms or of psilocybin for these participants, right? They weren't going nuts in these fMRI machines,
true.
Right? Oh, really? Okay.
For one thing, we gave them a high dose of psilocybin. And for a second thing, you know, they had some pretty, pretty amazing and powerful and often positive, but not always, experiences inside this, you know, big, loud, banging MRI machine.
Oh, my God. Because, like, I've been in an MRI. If anyone has been through an MRI, it's really, really loud. It's a terrible, right, big, you know, white machine that feels like it's going to crumple on you. And the idea that I thought this would be really low dose and just, you know, measuring. So these guys were really, they were really experiencing all that psilocybin can give them. What did you find about the effects of that in the brain then and afterwards?
Well, what we found while participants were on psilocybin, and yes, you're right, it was, I mean, a lot of credit to them to being willing and able to stay inside of a, you know, claustrophobic and loud magnet while they were having these powerful psychedelic experiences. But what we saw was that in these parts of the brain, the default mode network that I mentioned in particular, activity was just completely desynchronized, right? So normally it's very organized. And, you know, let's say you have a million neurons in a given brain area, and they are activating and deactivating in a very correlated and synchronized way. And when they were in the scanner on a high dose of psilocybin, it kind of just looked like chaos, right? It kind of looked like every area was, you know, every kind of neuron was firing off in its own pattern. And in fact, the degree to which that was happening correlated very strongly with people's subjective report of how strong the psychedelic experience was, and in particular, how strong the mystical experience with, which includes kind of this loss of ego and a sense of, you know, changes in your perception of space and time. And it correlated strongly with this desynchronization and default mode network.
So that was what happened then. But I think what was really interesting is that I suppose we would expect that, right? We would expect to see the brain doing crazy stuff while people are looking in the mirror and seeing their ancestors, you know. Right. But if you go on to a couple of weeks and even a couple of months later, what was really interesting about the study, why we wanted to have you on, is that those changes, that there was a change even much, much later than the experiment.
Well, yeah. So the thing that we looked at, and you know, we know that from earlier research that I mentioned the default mode network, but also the hippocampus, those are two of the kind of core places where we think there is an increase in plasticity after taking psilocybin. And, you know, there's this interesting research, mostly in animals, suggesting that that might be critical to psilocybin's, you know, therapeutic potential and clinical potential. And so what we saw was that this specific connection between the hippocampus and the default mode network, after this high dose of psilocybin, it gets reset, right? And so this connection, which, you know, we think that it's important to creating the sense of self and, you know, defining habits and kind of stable behavior, it kind of seems to get reset for weeks after psilocybin. And that seems to be a potentially very important correlate of this increased flexibility and, you know, people's ability to change either maladaptive thought patterns or maladaptive behavior.
So, I mean, from sort of de-science that a bit, what essentially you're saying is that it sort of breaks apart the pieces of our thinking or experience that may have been a little bit more fixed. And if those fixed experiences or thoughts are negative, it maybe allow us to rearrange those pieces in a way that might be beneficial. But that is something that you kind of need to do more research for. Is that about right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And the other thing, you know, I'll add to that is that I think it also points to the importance of therapy in the clinical setting, that, you know, you can reset these circuits, you can make habits more flexible, but I think a good therapist can then take that flexibility and help somebody, you know, change their behavior in a healthy way, right?
So, yeah, so like psilocybin married with really positive CBT could have quite powerful results. So, I mean, look, I know that it's sometimes tricky to get this through, and there have been some, you know, sort of back and forth with trials, but it does seem to me to be an area of potential and certainly worth more study. It's been really great to have you on, and fascinating research. Thank you so much for joining us. That's Joshua Siegel. He's an assistant professor at the Department of Psychiatry at NYU Grossman. Thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Jonathan.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae,
proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.